Hey there, guys. This is Chad from Good Fight Ministries, and I'm so excited to share this interview. I would say we sat down, but really we stood up with Professor Nancy Piercy to talk about her book, The Toxic War on Masculinity. And one of the things I love about this is the fact that we get to talk about some truths that we have found out through just researching, specifically Nancy did. And what is awesome is we've used her in the past when talking about masculinity, and this kind of little sit-down interview that we did, in-person interview rather, that we did is an absolute blessing to me. And I was excited with how excited she was about giving this information out and also sharing the gospel. So sit down and watch this. And also, if you get a chance, make sure to buy her book because it is one of my favorite books that I've read, and that is The Toxic War on Masculinity.
The Good Fight Radio Show.
Welcome, Professor Nancy Piercy, to the Good Fight Radio Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to get right into this because it is a very important topic for me personally. I have four children. I've been a wrestler. I like weightlifting and all that stuff. And what does it mean to be a man? But more importantly, what does it mean to be a man biblically? And also, the toxic war on masculinity and how Christianity reconciles the sexes. I think just the title of the book is really important, Nancy. Why did you title it, first of all, The Toxic War on Masculinity? Because toxic masculinity is usually what I hear when I'm listening to people talk about it.
I knew that I had to get both words in there because that is the phrase. But I didn't want to even use the term toxic masculinity because that assumes I believe it exists, and I don't. I don't think masculinity is toxic. So I sort of did a play on words, you know, the toxic war on masculinity, so that people would kind of do a double take and say, wait, what? And it has worked that way. People have, it's caught their attention, you know, it's piqued their interest. And so that's the goal of any title, right? And so it does communicate, though, my view that it's really, the real problem is that men are being attacked today in our culture. You know, my eye was caught by headlines like the Washington Post had an article titled, Why Can't We Hate Men? And I thought, really? In a mainstream publication? A Huffington Post editor tweeted, hashtag kill all men. You can buy t-shirts that say so many men, so little ammunition. And books have come out with titles that are very blunt, like I hate men, and no good men, and are men necessary? And even some men are jumping on the bandwagon. There was a male book author who wrote, talking about healthy masculinity is like talking about healthy cancer. And then the final one, you probably saw this because it was in the news, but the director of the movie Avatar, did you see that when he said, James Cameron, he said testosterone is a toxin that you have to work out of your system. So this is why I first started saying, I have to write a book. I want to get to the bottom of this. Why is the secular world getting masculinity so wrong? You know, if you want to stand against the trend, you have to ask, where did it come from and how did it develop? And so that was my initial goal.
Well, that's perfect. And that gets us to our first, you know, question about this book, because I think it's good to start off because obviously there's a lot of bad news when it comes to what people believe about masculinity. But let's start with the good news. People often accuse evangelical Christian men of being oppressive patriarchs, prone to abuse. But you make the surprising claim that they test out as having the lowest levels of abuse. Can you try to explain that to me?
Yeah, so I sort of stumbled across this research showing that Christian men actually test out as the most loving and engaged fathers. And I realized I now had a book. I had the problem and I had the solution. You don't write a book until you got the solution. And so what happened is the media presents evangelical Christian men as exhibit A of toxic masculinity. I'll give you just one example. So the co-founder of the Church Two movement, which followed the Me Too movement, said the theology of male headship feeds the rape culture that we see permeating American Christianity today. So there were social scientists listening to this and saying, well, where's your evidence? You're making these charges, but where's your data? And so they went out and did the studies. And I quote about a dozen studies, all finding that actually Christian men who are active, who are committed, who are authentic in their faith, test out as the most loving and engaged husbands and fathers. They test the wives, they test them separately, which is important. And the wives test out as the happiest. with a husband's expressions of love and affection. They test out as spending most time with their children, 3.5 hours more per week than secular men. They have the lowest rate of divorce. They have the lowest rate of divorce, 35% lower than secular couples. And then the real surprise is they actually have the lowest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any major group in America. And sometimes a quote can crystallize it. So let me give you a quote. The researcher I relied on the most heavily is a sociologist at the University of Virginia. He's the head of the National Marriage Project. And to give you a sense of his stature, he gets invited to publish in places like the New York Times. So this was an article he wrote for the New York Times. And he said, and this is a direct quote, "It turns out that the happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives." They're looking especially at the wives, right? Because the assumption is these marriages are abusive to the wives. "The happiest of all wives in America are religious conservatives. Fully 73% of women who hold conservative gender values and attend church regularly with their husbands have high quality marriages." So that's data. That's evidence. That's not a pep talk from some religious leader. No, that's hard empirical evidence. So it's something we should be confident about bringing into the public square and also bringing into our churches to encourage men, you know, that they are doing a good job. I had a graduate student who was the head of the women's ministry at a large Baptist church in Houston, where I live. And she told me, on Mother's Day, we tell the mothers they're wonderful and we pass out roses. On Father's Day, we scold the men and tell them to do better. So my book says, no more scolding. You know, bring this data into the churches, too, to encourage and to support men who are doing a good job, who are really committed husbands and fathers.
I think that is so important. And, you know, it's interesting because you're kind of going against the grain here with what people think. And the truth is, most people would tell you, well, you know what? Christians get divorced at the same rate as non-believers. Every marriage, it's 50%. Who knows what's happening? So it's not like Christianity is helping when it comes to keeping couples actually together and committed to one another.
Yes, that's the first pushback I always get. In fact, last night on Twitter, I had posted something and I got four or five people all saying just that. So what the researchers went back to the data and they made a very crucial distinction between the men who are in fact committed Christians, which they can test in a very quantifiable way. It turns out just attending church is a very good measure of how committed these men are. And then they separated them out from nominal Christian men. My students don't even know what nominal means. So I tell them NOM is Latin for name. So it means in name only. So these are men who, on a survey like this, might check the Baptist box, for example, but who don't attend church, or rarely, if at all. It's a cultural background, family background. And these men test out shockingly different. They actually test out with all the toxic stereotypes. Their wives report the lowest level of happiness with the way their husbands treat them. They spend less time with their children. They have a higher divorce rate than even secular men, 20% higher. And they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any group in America. So this is what skews the statistics. If you see numbers saying, you know, evangelicals divorce at the same rate, they're actually combining men who are much better than secular men and men who are worse than secular men. So the numbers are very skewed. And it does suggest, you know, what our churches are up against, right? How can we, on the one hand, really encourage the men who are doing well? And how can we have a discipleship program that reaches out to these nominal men who are claiming the identity of evangelical, but who are actually, in a sense, destroying the reputation of evangelicals because people who know them then think, you know, evangelical men are actually worse than secular men.
Wow, I think that is so incredible. I think it's so important for people to hear that and to understand. And it, like you said, for those nominal, hey, maybe this is the reason, the benefits of being in Christ, in fellowship, and actually having a living relationship with Jesus Christ, all those things are going to benefit your children. And one of the things you bring out a lot, and I found this one maybe the most interesting, is the idea of actually the Industrial Revolution and how that changed men in the household and men taking care of their children, how much time they spent with them. Maybe speak to that a bit too, because I think that was one of the more important aspects for me reading this as a father.
Yeah, if you want to know where the hostile language against men came from, you have to go back to where it started. And many people really do think it started in the 1960s, second wave feminism. But it actually started in the 19th century after the Industrial Revolution. Because before that, men worked with their families all day, right, with their wives and children. And the cultural expectation on men really focused on their caretaking role. In fact, surprising historical fact, most books and articles written on parenting were addressed to men, not mothers, as most of them are today. And men did, in fact, spend as much time with their kids as mothers did, especially their sons. You know, the sons were basically apprentices alongside their fathers in their craft or trade. And even secular historians will say the concept of masculine virtue, the concept of masculine virtue back then was duty to God and man. That's how they put it. So the question is, how did we lose that? The Industrial Revolution took work out of the home, and of course men had to follow their work out of the home into offices and factories. And for the first time in American history, they were not working with people they loved and had a moral bond with, you know, their family members. They were working as individuals in competition with other men. And their character began to change. And that's the first time you see people begin to protest that men were becoming egocentric, individualistic, ego-driven, greedy and acquisitive, to use some of the language of the day, and even turning financial success into an idol. I was surprised to see how many people in the 19th century used the language of men are turning their career into an idol. And so if you want to go back to where the language began to turn negative, this is when it was. And of course, it does suggest what the solution is. If the language turned negative at the Industrial Revolution, when men were separated from their families, the solution has to be, how can we reintegrate men better into their families, you know, even in an industrial age? Are there ways to flex the workplace and give men, you know, a greater connection with their families?
Amen. And, you know, something that we talked about even before we started recording regarding with COVID, with everything that happened with COVID and, you know, men being back in the house with their family. And you talked about a study that actually came out that talked about how the fathers actually felt about that. And I know it's not in the book, but I thought it'd be interesting to talk about.
Right. So I do have a whole chapter in the book on ways that the workplace can be flexed, you know, to allow parents better to be better integrated into their family. You know, I'd like to recreate, in a sense, a pre-industrial age when both fathers and mothers could be engaged in economically productive work, but also while raising their children. And yes, after the pandemic, Harvard University actually did a study. And they found that 68% of fathers said during the pandemic, they got closer to their children and they don't want to lose that. And I thought that was wonderful because the pandemic was a real game changer. And it showed CEOs, you know, it showed corporations that it works too. I have some quotes from CEOs in my book where they said, you know, we were kind of skeptical about remote work. We thought people would slough off. We did not see that at all. During the pandemic, when people were working remotely, we did not see any drop in productivity. In fact, I have a couple of corporations, you know, CEOs and other leaders who say things like, when you give fathers more time to be better fathers, they actually are better workers. You know, they're more committed, they're more industrious. They may not come into the office as much, like work late, come in on Saturday, but their time on the job is more productive. So that was fascinating to see that the research is showing that they did some studies on this and they found that fathers who are connected to their families are actually better workers.
Wow, I think that is amazing. What a beautiful thing to see for people to actually understand that. I think it's really important for fathers to see that they need to be in their children's lives. You know, it's huge. And, you know, something you also bring out in the book, it talks about how Darwinian theory of evolution actually normalized many of the traits in men that today are labeled so toxic, which I find very interesting coming from a secular society having issues with this. But how so does Darwinian theory of evolution normalize many of these bad traits that we see today?
Yeah, so in my book, I explain where the secular script for masculinity came from. You know, like I said, you can't stand against a trend unless you know where it came from. And one of the important turning points was the rise of Darwinian evolution. And most of us are surprised, right? That's a theory of science. But it had an enormous impact on views of masculinity because Darwinian thinkers began to write that the men who came out on top in the struggle for survival would be ruthless, brutal, savage, barbarian, and predatory. That's the language that they used. And in fact, it was called social Darwinism back then. Today, it's got a new label. It's called evolutionary psychology. But they're saying the same thing. There's a recent book called The Moral Animal, and the best-selling book, by the way. And the author says, the human male is a possessive, oppressive, flesh-obsessed pig. Giving him advice on how to have a better marriage is like giving a Viking a book on how not to pillage. And I thought, how do you get away with such a negative view of men? From a secular position, you've got a much more negative view of men than we do from a Christian perspective. And then there's another one, actually. It's an older book that was just reissued called Men and Marriage. And he was also an evolutionary psychologist. He said, the male nature is, by nature, male character is by nature violent, addicted, irresponsible, and sexually predatory. Men's deepest yearning is not for wife and family. It's for the open road, for the male escape. And he literally uses the word to a predatory and immediate gratification. And my response to that is, that's worse than any feminist. And yet these are male authors. And what we have to say is that really men's deepest yearning? No, God created men to be involved in family. When God creates the human race, he doesn't create an autonomous individual, surveying the wilderness. He creates a couple, and they're married. So marriage and family is deeply rooted in the male character. The secularists are wrong about this. It's deeply rooted, and men are... Here's another study, by the way, another Harvard study. It was the longest study ever done of men. It was 80 years. And they asked, what makes men happy? And they found it was not fame or financial success or career advancement. It was warm, committed, loving relationships. Men. And so... The research is reinforcing what the Bible says. When God says the first commandment is love God, the second commandment is love your neighbor as yourself. In today's secular world, the idea that men's primary life goal should be to love is revolutionary.
I love it. This is so great. And I really hope anyone can go and grab this book, because I think it would be such a blessing to people. Now, where can they go to not only grab this book, but also love thy body? And I mean... You have other works that you've done as well. Where could they go to pick something like this up?
Of course, you can go to Amazon, like for everything, or if you prefer, christianbook.com. But my publisher very generously redesigned my webpage, so it's colorful and fun now. Come on over to nancypiercy.com, and Piercy is C-E-Y, piercy.com. And you can browse my other books there, and... what else I've written. You can leave a message, which I really enjoy hearing from people. So come on over to nancypiercy.com and say hello.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy. It has been awesome having you on the Good Fight Radio Show, and I actually would love to do it again back in studio.
Thank you. I would love that too.
You've been listening to the Good Fight Radio Show with pastor and author Joe Schimmel and host Chad Davidson, discussing contemporary issues in light of the Bible and how they relate to family, culture, and the church. To learn more about Good Fight Ministries, visit us online at goodfight.org. Join our growing social media family and consider partnering with us at patreon.com/goodfight.